But my question is, what are the odds that PG&E will actually do it? Just to try to pin you down, is this something that is a reasonable likelihood, depending on what you find out there? Or is it something that you really don't plan on doing? You intend to see the plant through decommissioning, but
that we are ready to go.
Okay.
And I'd like to welcome everybody to the Health Commission meeting, and I'd like to thank the health commissioners for serving our community. Just a few things. If you are looking to do public comment, please email public comment during the meeting to mcoughlin@co.slo.ca.us for agenda or for information about the Health Commission. Please Google San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. For the members, as part of housekeeping, if you are interested in speaking at the topic, please raise your hand or notify us verbally if you're on the phone that you'd like to speak, and then please wait for the chairperson to recognize you before speaking. With that being said, I'd like to turn the meeting over to our chairperson, Mary Jean Sage.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for being with us, everyone. I'll apologize up front for the lighting in my office now that we have had the time change and it is dark outside. I realize I have terrible lighting in my office, which I will change before next month. But we will go ahead and call the meeting to order, please. We have not had any recent public comment that has come in, although Mike forwarded to each of us a bit of public comment that came in over the last month. Hopefully you all got that. If there are any comments or any issues that you guys would like to discuss at some point, we can certainly bring that up a little bit later. So we have with us this evening as our guest, Garrett Olson, who's the CEO of the Slo Food Bank. And I've asked Garrett to be with us to fill us in a little bit about what's been happening with the food bank during the pandemic, what perhaps some of their needs might be as we're going forward into that holiday time of year when we know that lots of families have needs. So, Garrett, thank you for being with us. And the floor, so to speak, is yours.
Thank you so much. I want to make sure that you can hear me.
Yeah, we can.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Mary Jean and commissioners. It is really my honor to talk with you. This is a very timely discussion as we move into the holiday season and we continue to see the effects of the pandemic ravaging our community and our clients in need. And so I will be very respectful of time, of your time. And what I'm going to provide you with is a little bit of information on the food bank pre-pandemic, what's happened to us and our clients since the pandemic, what's changed, why this is a public health issue, and then what can you and the public do to assist us in our mission moving forward. And please feel free to stop me at any point if you have a question. I'd be more than happy to answer that for you. And if you ask me a stumper, I will get back with you with the answer. I'll share with you that I have been the CEO at the Slo Food Bank since May, and so there are probably a lot of questions you'll have that that I would find the answer to be very interesting as well, and I will be the steward of finding that interesting and accurate answer for you. Prior to the pandemic, the San Luis Obispo Food Bank Coalition was feeding approximately 1 in 6 of our county residents. So approximately 17% of our county residents were food insecure. Our footprint is the entire county. Our formal name is the Food Bank Coalition of San Luis Obispo County. Our shortened name, doing business as Slo Food Bank, is just so it rolls off the tongue a little bit easier than that. But truly, from California Valley to the coast and from San Miguel to Napomo, we provide service to all of our clients in need. And we do so through two primary ways of getting food into the community. We have 81 agency partners that source their food from us in their mission to provide food to their hungry clients. So everything from churches that provide congregate feeding or pantry operations, Cal Poly and Cuesta College have pantries that feed students that are in need, and there are a lot of students that are in need. Somewhere around 11% of all students at four-year universities experience hunger during their tenure there. And then we have shelters like Echo Shelter and Rise and Stand Strong and 40 Prado. If the issue is hunger, chances are we are a partner in executing on that mission. And when the pandemic struck, the California Association of Food Banks, which is the umbrella under which we sit, hired the Stanford Data Labs to take a look at hunger county by county. And we know that through Stanford Data Labs analytics that hunger in San Luis Obispo County went up a tragic 154%. So whereas we were about 17% pre-pandemic, we are now hovering around 2 in 5 or almost 40%. And the math on that means that there are approximately 74,000 San Luis Obispo County residents that are food insecure. And tragically, approximately a third of those are children under the age of 18, and approximately a quarter of those are isolated seniors. When the pandemic struck, we tripled the amount of food by volume we were shipping out of our warehouse. We quite literally threw our doors open and started pushing food out into the community via our distribution sites and our agency partners. We literally went from 6 weeks of food in our inventory on premise here to 7 weeks of inventory over the span of 6 weeks. So a 73% reduction of our inventory in less than 2 months. And we were ordering food as fast as we possibly could. We are still providing hunger relief in this county at historic levels. I was on a recent conference call through the National Office of Food Banks, and they had hired a non-food bank affiliated economist to study past downturns in the economy and project when she and her firm thought that we would return to a tragic normal of pre-pandemic hunger of 1 in 6. I was prepared for her to say 2 years because that was what we were planning on. Her answer was 10. 10 years before we return. And the analytics, it wasn't a guess on her part, obviously. The analytics into all of the significant systemic changes in employment and the economy and where this has put people in their lives. We know that before the pandemic struck, approximately 40% of Americans had no more than $400 in their rainy day fund. And it doesn't take a whole lot of time being unemployed or having a significant reduction in hours for you to completely deplete that. The face of hunger in our community, tragically, is the face of our neighbor. And I literally see that when I go out to our distribution sites, where you will see neighbors in tears confronting and embracing each other in our COVID-safe way of doing that, not realizing how many of their friends are lining up to get food because they're there as well. It didn't take long. So what's changed? Let me start with the good that has changed. My hat goes off to our County Board of Supervisors and our County Chief Administrative Officer, Wade, for an incredible program that very early on partnered between the county and the Slo Food Bank. The county very early on, it was actually the program that brought me to consult for the food bank and then ultimately become the CEO. The county and the food bank entered into an agreement where the county provided the food bank with $650,000 worth of spending capacity for us to be able to get ahead of this historic need for food. We could not have stayed ahead of the explosion in need if not for the partnership with the county. It is a model that every time I get a chance to talk to my peers across the state and nation that I tout. There are few other counties that have such an incredible relationship between their county board of supervisors and their food bank. And I will tell you, it made the difference in our county, not just for our food bank operations, but more importantly for our clients in need. Second thing that's going well is our governor cares deeply about people in need. We just learned a couple of weeks ago about the governor putting another $90 million into hunger relief statewide. $40 million of that is going to be allocated based on the operating costs of the individual food banks. So we'll be prorated. LA Food Bank and some of the others will get the lion's share of that. But we will get a proportionate amount of that funding. and $50 million is going towards food purchased by the state and then distributed again on a pro rata basis to the food banks. And so we anticipate that we will move into 2021 on stable footing, probably for the first 3 to 6 months, which is a position that two weeks ago we didn't anticipate. That doesn't mean that we don't have incredible outstanding needs and that there isn't an incredible amount that the community can do, and I'll get to that at the end, but I just wanted to highlight that our state government is doing it right. So federal government, I will never put a stick in the eye of somebody that's offering assistance, but when that assistance that doesn't meet the needs of our clients, I will always offer methods where that assistance could be better formulated. We've received food boxes through the federal government, and those food boxes have been put to good use, but many times they've arrived in a format that is not based on our clients' needs. The first round of CARES Act hunger relief resulted in us getting 40 to 50 pound boxes of food, which our clients can't carry, much less be able to use before some of that produce goes bad. The third round that we received, it's probably been about a month ago, were boxes of food, and the food contained shelf-stable food, fresh produce, fresh dairy, and frozen meat. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know where I'm going to put that food in our warehouse in between receiving it and handing it out to a client, so that the food, if I put it in the freezer, then I kill the dairy and the produce and jeopardize the shelf-stable food. If I just put it out in the warehouse, then all of the food that's temperature-sensitive goes to waste. So we've been breaking it apart. We're not letting any food go to waste. Again, we are appreciative for that, and we are putting that to good use. But we're really hopeful, and we've been talking with those who speak with our state and federal partners about maybe seeing the food banks as the clients rather than the distributors. We're still going to go to those same distributors, and they're still going to get that money for food relief, but we're going to put it in a formula way of giving it out that makes sense for our clients and the logistics of running the food bank. So that's been good. We've seen a good flow of support. Sometimes a little disinformed, but we pivot on that, and we make good use of every dollar and every ounce of food that's given to us. So what's worrisome? The end of unenhanced employment benefits and without a replacement there is very worrisome to us. We saw that the insecurity was really tempered up until late July, and we've seen it rise once again. And so we're seeing that same cycle like you see with COVID. We see that same cycle with people's financial security leading to food insecurity. The increase in COVID cases is obviously worrisome for all of us, and it's very worrisome to us. And donor fatigue and the realities of so many nonprofits needing assistance, we know that is challenging for people. And then the last one that I'll end with is our change in food donation logistics. So every year we bring in approximately $697,000 worth of donated food. And so that's through programs like Stamp Out Hunger that the U.S. Postal Service does for us, where people leave food by their door and their postal workers will pick it up in March, April. It's what's going on now with the Turkey Drive and Season of Hope. We are not able to receive household or food donation scale donations right now for several reasons. The most prominent of those reasons is the logistics of our warehouse. We are processing food for delivery in our warehouse at historic levels and maintaining 6 feet distance from all of our staff and volunteers in the warehouse. We don't have the size of warehouse or the size of staff and volunteers to simultaneously be building historic levels of food to go out in the community while also receiving tens of thousands of pounds worth of donated food, all of which has to be individually inspected to confirm that it's in good shape and that it matches our nutritional standards. So we've seen a loss of $697,000 worth of food donations this year alone. Why is this a public health issue? probably preaching to the choir here, but we know that there is a real connection between food insecurity and health issues. And we know that when people don't have enough money for food, there are trade-offs in their life, and sometimes the trade-offs are medications that they need. And so we see a particularly elderly population, we see a lot of folks choosing food over medicine. We also know that when people have not much money for food, oftentimes they are lured into buying the cheap processed food. And it drives me that whenever the media reports on people coming to food banks, that you will see obese and out-of-shape people getting food at our food bank distributions, and people will wrongfully assume that person's overweight, there's no way they could need food, and nothing could be further from the truth. The connection between poor nutrition and obesity is more directly tied to that obesity than eating too much nutritious food. And so sadly, a lot of people will make a false assumption about many of our clients that if our clients are not thin, that they can't be hungry. They are simply getting non-nutritious food because they are financially insecure, and in many cases, they live in food deserts in our county where the only place where they can get food is perhaps a Circle K or a 7-Eleven, and they're not getting fresh fruit, produce, and meat at that location. Again, one-third of our clients are children, and we know their lives have been turned upside down this year with the school year and all of the other challenges that they have. And finally, I'll leave it at this. There have been great studies that have been done on the connection between food insecurity and health issues. And for children, just real quickly, some of the impacts of food insecurity include worsening of asthma, behavioral and social emotional problems, developmental risk, iron deficiency, anemia, less physical activity, low birth weight, low bone density, lower health status, lower quality of life, lower physical functioning, mental health problems. The list goes on and on and on. And if I crossed over and talked about our clients at the other end of the spectrum that are seniors, the list is equally as tragic and life-threatening. So this is absolutely a huge public health issue. So my ask of you with my remaining 1 minute of time is just to help us get the word out. We've gone virtual on just about every event that normally would be an in-person event. This is the time of year when we normally love to have our trucks parked outside of grocery stores where people go in and buy a turkey, and then we put the turkey in the truck and we deliver it to our clients in need. We're not able to do that, and so our turkey drive is virtual. The beautiful thing about giving to us is, from wherever you are right now watching this, you can give us turkey money to provide food to people during the holidays. It has never been easier to give. You can just literally go to slowfoodbank.org/donate. Every dollar donated, we turn into an astounding 7 nutritious meals. That is not a marketing ploy. We get audited on that number every year by an independent auditor. We turn every dollar into 7 nutritious meals. And they're not just meals. They are nutritious meals. We have high nutrition standards, which sets us apart from a lot of other food banks across the United States. When we used to accept donations and somebody would give us a case of cherry pie filling, we would not give that to our clients. That is not what hungry people need. Hungry people don't just need food for their bellies. They need food to fuel their bodies and their minds. And so every dollar goes to 7 nutritious meals. Our season of hope, we're challenged in that. Normally, we're collecting upwards of 25,000 pounds of food. Our turkey drive, normally we're collecting thousands of turkeys. So if you could use your platform to help us deliver our threefold message. Our message is, number one, if you need help, we're here to help you. Our message number two is, if you're making it by and you're struggling, we are your safety net. We're rooting for your success, but we are here to help you. We're here to catch you in hunger. And number three, if you are in a position to give at whatever level is comfortable and meaningful to you, we will be thoughtful stewards of turning every dollar donated into 7 nutritious meals. And I think I've used all of my time. But I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. And I thank you so very much for helping to shine the light on this really important issue.
Thank you, Gareth. That was very informative. Let's see who might have questions. Nobody has questions? Oh, yes. Okay. Candace, we'll start with you, then Ginger, then Tamar.
Hi, Gareth. Thank you so much for that presentation. That was great and timely. So I've actually been a little bit in touch with you through Tara Davis. She's a volunteer coordinator. I teach at Cal Poly.
Okay.
I've sent volunteers to y'all in the past. And I guess what I wanted to ask whether or not you still need people power in addition to the money, and if the connection is still through Tara, and because she was sending us to Wilshire. Is that still how it's going?
So we do have a new volunteer coordinator. I told you we have high nutritional standards, and we have a nutrition program manager on staff. That's Tara. She just recently promoted into that position, which is, if you know Tara, is great news because she is absolutely amazing. Our new volunteer coordinator is Carolyn Bird, and people can call our main number, which is 805-238-4664. And we still do need volunteers. The great thing about so many people working from home and having the ability to flex their schedules is that we have had a great showing of volunteers. So some of our volunteers, many of our volunteers pre-pandemic were retired seniors, and some of those folks have not been able to come in because they're self-isolating. We've had a great showing from Cal Poly, and we service clubs, Rotary clubs, a lot of organizations have really stepped up. So we can always use more volunteers. But at last count, I think we're about 2 to 3 weeks booked out into the future, which is a beautiful problem to have.
That's great.
Yeah.
And can you tell me the name of your volunteer coordinator again? I'm sorry, I was listening, but not all the way.
Her name is Carolyn Bird. And her email address is cbird, B-I-R-D, at slowfoodbank.org.
Great. Thank you. I'll send some students your way.
That would be lovely. Thank you so much.
Hi. Ginger.
Hi, Garrett.
Hi.
My turn. Okay. Great presentation. Very informative. I'm a dietitian in a women's health clinic, and I just actually had a patient last week. I pulled up the food bank website and was trying to encourage her to go to one of the stops. And I was curious, looking at the different locations, it says there are some that said pantry, some that said pickup only. And so I'm curious, what can I explain to patients what to expect when they go to some place that says a pantry versus a food bank, or is it the same thing, or when it says pickup only, what can they expect?
That's a great question. And it really, so we've got 60 sites that we go to, and that is where we go out and we provide what we refer to as a household unit of food. It is one large bag, approximately 15 to 20 pounds of fresh California produce, and one large bag, approximately 20 pounds of shelf-stable food. So whole grain pasta and canned tuna and the like. When it is a food bank distribution, that's what is going to be provided. When it's one of the 81 agency partners like God's Storehouse at Grace Church in downtown SLO, that's a pantry operation. And so we provide them food, they source food from us, but the logistics of how they provide the food to their clients varies by all 81 of them. So the easiest way for anybody that needs help is for them simply to call us and give us their address, and we'll do an intake and ask them about what their needs are, what their mobility is. We've actually just started. We're getting ready to. We're in a pilot program to start. I don't know if that makes any sense. A new home delivery program for isolated seniors. That's where, if your client is over the age of 65, that's where you might have been referred to Wilshire. So we started this new program, and our staff is just brilliant and efficient. And so we're, instead of us taking on the whole thing, including case management, we're using Wilshire to do case management because they're good at that. We're using Ride On Slow, another nonprofit, to do the delivery so we don't go out and buy a bunch of Priuses and incur that cost. And we're sourcing the food ourselves. So it's a partnership between the three. If your client is 65 or older, the reason why she was referred to Wilshire is because she's likely a candidate for the home delivery program. And that was a program that was an outgrowth from our great partnership with the county. The county was helping provide home delivery for isolating seniors, regardless of whether or not they met the economic threshold for need. They met the public health need to stay home. Now Wilshire is helping us with making sure that people meet the economic threshold. So a single person, the economic threshold for being in need is somewhere around $25,000 a year pre-tax. For a couple, it's about $51,000. Pre-tax.
What if I'm getting a lot more pregnant teens in my office? Is there any like certain threshold for them, or any extra anything that might be provided?
And so, living at home, living on their own, varies.
Kind of varies, yeah.
Okay. So here's the beauty of our service. When people come here to ask for food, we're not normally a distribution point, but during the pandemic, an explosion of people showing up at our warehouse that are food insecure and looking for food because they quite literally Googled food bank and came here thinking that we were like a regular bank and this is where you're going to get food. We never turn people away without giving them food. So we give them food and then we give them information on our distribution sites and agency partners. We do not check to confirm financial status. Nobody's getting rich off of getting food from the food bank. We know that, and those agencies that regulate us know that. Pre-pandemic days, when you came to get food, there would be a sign-in sheet, and you would initial your name. We didn't check IDs. You would tell us how many people were in your household and what zip code you lived in, and that would just help us with the demographics for our reporting. A sheet of paper next to that would list the economic criteria to be eligible for need. And it's the honor system. People would know I shouldn't be signing this side if I don't meet the eligibility over here. So if you have pregnant teens or teens for whatever matter, anybody for whatever matter that needs food, our interest is in making sure that they get the food. So that food is absolutely available. At Cuesta College and at Cal Poly, they're open pantries. You don't sign anything. You just go up and get food. We like that. We also like the fact that that helps remove some of the stigma around being food insecure. So if you have something, if there's a specific client need that you have, Ginger, please have them call us and we will help them figure out how to get the food reached.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Tamara?
Thanks. Garrett, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. Just a couple of questions for you. One, can you speak to the anonymity process for people who may want to come, who may not want their neighbors to know, who may not want to sort of be part of, you know, running into people that they may know? Can you speak to what that process may be like for people around that? And then I've got one other question for you.
Okay. So most distributions now are pop the trunk, we load the food in, you drive away. And we stand a good distance away from people. And so people are fairly anonymous in their vehicles. And we are somewhat centrally located with our operations here at the warehouse. And so if somebody had transportation abilities, or we made sure that we are on a mass transit route, or somebody wanted to come here, they could come here and get food and would be completely anonymous. And then for our agency partners, certainly if they were, you know, if they live in Atascadero Loaves and Fishes is one of our agency partners. They are lovely, lovely people. people, they could certainly call and say, you know, I don't feel comfortable coming in when there are a lot of other people there. Can you give me a recommendation on a time of day when I might be able to do my shopping with a little bit more anonymity?
That's great. That's really helpful. Thank you. And then the second question I had was really, you summarized so well sort of your top three reasons why to give. And I was wondering if you might be able to share those in bullet format with the commission so that when we reach out to people, we have our talking points to help spread the word. And also that your explanation around why you really can't take the usual in-person food donations. I thought that was a really interesting point because I think for many people, they feel like that's still a possibility and can do that. And so I would love to be able to spread the word that a monetary donation is really the best way to give. And so if you don't mind including sort of that reason why, I think that would probably make a big difference in being able to convince people and get them on, you know, to be more active in making sure that they're able to give and donate.
Absolutely. I can put I threw some handwritten notes together. I could put them together and send them to you with those points. And I'll share with you, when cash is king in any disaster, I mean, you ask somebody after a hurricane, you know, do you want, I actually went to New York after 9/11 and helped them with that recovery process and was actually in logistics. And when people would say, we've got X amount of worker clothes in California that we want to send you, we're like, no, please don't do that. Just send us the money. We'll buy them over here. We'll buy exactly what we need. We don't have to worry about storing them and all of that. The other beauty about monetary donations is our purchasing power is tremendous. When we buy tuna, we don't buy a can of tuna for 79 cents or I don't know what it is, $1.29. We buy a pallet of tuna. And so our purchasing power is about a 4-to-1 ratio. So if you were going to go out tomorrow and buy us $10 worth of peanut butter, which is a good protein and kids like it, if you gave us $10, we're going to buy $40 worth of peanut butter. And we're going to buy it in a form factor that allows us to put it in our warehouse and not have to inspect it. It comes on a pallet. All of it has the same expiration date. All of it has the same nutritional values. So right now, cash is king. We're not insensitive to the impact on the local economy of people donating money to us and us going to the open market and buying pallets of peanut butter. That doesn't help Smart and Final in San Luis Obispo when that happens. And we get that. And we are really, really mindful of balancing that. So much so that while the shelf-stable food that we can buy at a much greater value than if you were to go to Smart and Final or somewhere else like that. On the flip side, we have been historically buying produce from throughout California, and we are really trying to focus closely on making sure that we're supporting our local farmers and growers. Ultimately, that means that their employment goes up and their salaries go up, and the people that are food insecure in our county goes down. So we see that connection. And as soon as we can transition back to accepting food donations that allow people to go and shop at our local stores and support our local grocers, that is absolutely a priority for us. Right now, it is quite honestly it's a space issue for us in our warehouse. We can't keep people 6 feet distance and also push food out and inspect all of the food that comes in. Yeah, cash is king.
Any sort of, you know, sound bites, bullet points would be great. We'd like to be able to, you know, share that across our networks, you know, both in person and digital. So anything that you may have that could be repurposed, or, you know, even if you have any sort of infographics or anything that you may share on your social media sites, whatever it might be, it would be helpful to just have pass those along to us, and we're happy to distribute how we can.
Thank you. If you go to our Instagram feed, we are really, really active there. And we would love for you to repost or like or participate in our campaigns. We have just an amazing team that helps us make sure that we stay relevant and current with our posts every day. And I will send, I'm guessing back to Michael would be the best way for me to get a document to the rest of the commissioners. Okay.
And then Mike can distribute it to the rest of us.
Wonderful.
So, but Tamar, you're going to have to teach some of us how to do Instagram. I do Facebook, but Instagram, I can't figure that out yet.
We actually post to both. Every post we do to Instagram, we mirror it to Facebook.
Sure. So we should all go on to those and like it, and then it goes out to all of our networks and everything. Any other questions? Well, again, thank you, Garrett. This is very enlightening. It was a pleasure to have you with us, and we'll look forward to having you back again sometime. Maybe we'll be out of the pandemic by then, but who knows? But we'll look for an update soon anyway, okay?
Thank you so much. I really appreciate helping share the message.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
For your work.
Have a good night. Bye-bye.
So, at this point, does anybody have any update from any of our previous meetings? We've been Zooming for a long time now, and I think we'll be Zooming for a time to go yet, but, okay. Well, let's go ahead and have Dr. Rosen give us our public health report. Thanks for being with us, Rick.
Sure, thank you. So, it looks like we are in the middle of a surge of COVID-19 cases at the moment. Over the weekend, the county experienced 225 new cases, which is a pretty big number for us. And on the testing front, we are seeing once again a shortage of reagents to varying degrees with the different testing platforms that has impacted our ability to test with our workhorse testing platform. So we've had to do some juggling in that regard. We did borrow some supplies from Marion Hospital as well as CHC, and that was helpful. That got us through the weekend. Last week we did issue a new guidance related to the performing arts. So we have had ongoing conversations with the performing arts community, who understandably is hurting. And the idea is that performances are possible through a drive-in, essentially the drive-in theater guidance. So it's possible to watch performances in your vehicles. And it also addressed performances without live audiences. In other news, so one topic that is gaining momentum at the moment is sports. So a lot of questions around sports related to schools. Various sports programs are practicing currently, both at Cal Poly and at Cuesta. And some high school teams have also started practicing under the state's cohort guidance, so in smaller groups. That we've seen some mixed results with that. So clusters of cases associated with various sports activities at both the high school level and the collegiate level, but nothing terrible or nothing too remarkable in terms. And we found that the various programs have been very cooperative with quarantining and that sort of thing. In addition, in terms of testing, we are working on more testing options through the state. So the California Department of Public Health put out an invitation to various counties, really to all the counties across the state, to express interest in further testing. So we did apply for that, and we will hear this week how that turns out. Hopefully that will enable us to have a mobile testing unit that can move around to various sites. So again, we'll find out fairly soon what that looks like. And lastly, since our last meeting, we had our public point of distribution exercise for the influenza vaccine. That was very successful, and we vaccinated a lot of people. Unfortunately, I don't have the numbers for that, but I do know that we burned through almost all of our flu vaccine, and we're very happy with the turnout. Mike might actually know the numbers on that.
Sorry, we had just under 1,200. With Paso being the majority of the testing, and I believe Arroyo Grande was at 500 people that were vaccinated.
And that's it. That's all I have to report.
Anybody have questions for Dr. Rosen? Tamar, go ahead, and then Tom.
Candace.
Go ahead,
Tamar. Sorry. Just a quick question on the flu vaccine, Dr. Rosen. Do we have any data as to just generally across the county how many people are being vaccinated for the flu through pharmacies, doctors, that sort of thing?
Good question. I do not have those numbers.
But that's something the county tracks.
Yes. So we would get that through the state.
Okay.
Another element that we're interested in is the rate of vaccination amongst healthcare workers. I don't have that information either yet, but I'm curious to see how that is going.
Tom, go ahead with your question. But you need to unmute yourself. We can't hear you, Tom. You need, there you go.
There we go. I forgot the mute button. Yeah. Thank you. Well, Dr. Rosen, I've got questions kind of in two categories, event venues and service clubs. I'm involved with both, but just the parallel I want to draw as we were talking about food bank. Well, you know, I'm involved with president of our Kiwanis Club. Last summer, we did about a $40,000 fundraiser for Loaves and Fishes. This last weekend, we just did about a $9,000 raising of a golf tournament for Loaves and Fishes. I've hosted some virtual events for Rise. They have their Wine, Women, and Shoes event that went virtual this year. The challenge is event venues are struggling to find their way, how they can do things, and also same with service clubs. And yet these are some of the very locations that are doing some of these events that bring in money for, I've worked with a lot of folks that focus on community events that raise money for these kind of things. And an example was, now, as you know, the rules are different for different circumstances. We can do a wedding ceremony at a venue I own, and we can have 100 or 200 people currently under a certain, as long as it's a ceremony, not a reception. However, when we wanted to do an event related to some of these fundraiser things, the limit was 10 people on site, and it's tough to do a virtual event with only 10 people. And so I think now, and I'll stop whining there, but I think with the outbreak coming or an increase, there's a real concern that this could even set the groups that really don't have the right category even farther back. And what do you see? It seems like it is more related to Cal Poly coming back, more population, and or you can pinpoint our, do you think the future is kind of going to be able to target what populations are, can need, have more assistance, and how to differentiate between some of these groups that might be able to do some service and follow all of the precautions?
Right. So unfortunately, I don't see that changing until we have a significantly different picture in terms of our case rate. And right now, we're more likely to move back to the purple tier than we are to move down to the orange tier. So unfortunately, I don't see that changing in the near future.
Not looking good.
Your question about Cal Poly is an interesting one. So we'll have to, you know, that class on-campus instruction ends on November 20th. So we'll have to see what happens thereafter. There may or may not be a significant decrease in cases. It's hard to, so for our purposes, the students that are factoring into our case counts are those that live off campus.
Now, it looks like the elementary schools are going to be increasing about that same time. They're going to be.
Yes.
So, do you have any crystal ball predictions on that?
No, so I can say that the schools that have been open under the waiver program and those that have opened in a limited extent, either via reopening or through the cohort model, have done fairly well. We haven't had to shut down any schools to date based upon outbreaks. And that has been reassuring. There have been cases, there have been clusters associated with schools, but nothing to the threshold where we would, again, where we would shut a school down. And generally that figure is 5%. So 5% of the total number of staff and students has COVID.
Thank you. Last simple question, because it probably doesn't have much of an answer yet either, but with the last lawsuit round with the governor, do you see any changes in how the governor might issue executive orders, or is there any change you've seen? I don't know if that's had any impact locally, if you're still pretty much, your guidance is pretty clear that you have at the county level.
Right, so we do follow the state guidance, and we'll turn to the CDC in cases where there's a gap. That being said, I don't anticipate. I think the big guidance from the state that folks have been waiting on relates to sports. So a lot of people are wondering what to do about high school sports. Given our surge in cases, I'm not entirely clear what's going to happen there. So the plans that the state was making were based on lower case counts from a couple of weeks ago. So and meanwhile, high schools are planning on the fall sports season starting the first or second week in December. So I think that'll end up being sort of a last minute decision. Otherwise, I don't see any significant guidance or change in direction from the state that I can think of.
Okay.
Well, I will say though, well, I suppose one thing is that the state has built sort of a super lab in Valencia. With a goal of processing 150,000 COVID tests a day to start and scaling up from there. and that is already already in action. But that's not necessarily, I think, what you're getting at. So we will see more testing, and that's already happening.
Okay, thanks.
Sure, thank you.
Other questions? Candace, go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Dr. Rosen. So I have three questions. The first is to bounce off of your that new lab in Valencia.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that would be able to increase our screening or surveillance testing so that we could do more of that in the public schools? Or is that something that's going to be augmenting our regular kind of diagnostic testing?
So that is a great question. That relates to the invitation that the state put out to the various counties. It is possible to use that for surveillance testing, and we hope to do that. But we'll find out this week sort of what that would look like for us.
Right, because, I mean, obviously you can't do surveillance testing if you can't meet your diagnostic testing. Like, you have to do that first, right?
Right. Yeah, right.
So I'm really concerned, you know, as a Cal Poly professor, about our students going home and bringing COVID with them. And then I'm also concerned about them coming back.
Right.
So both, right?
Right.
What is your best, most concise advice to a student right now for them to avoid bringing COVID with them?
Oh, when they come back?
Going home. To their parents and grandparents.
So I think families should take appropriate precautions with college students coming back home, which would mean, sort of regardless of testing, I think plays a very small role in that. I think mask wearing, distancing, sort of, you know, possible quarantining. I would consider college a high risk activity, although it's not it doesn't make the CDC, you know, paragraph list of high risk activities, right? So if possible, quarantine would be ideal. Short of that, distancing and mask wearing.
So what I've been telling my students, and you can tell me that I'm over the top if you want to, that's fine. But if they're worried about a vulnerable person at their home, I tell them to quarantine for 2 weeks before they get back, or to quarantine when they get there. So that would mean masking at home and staying away from their people. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That would be the ideal.
And then if testing's available, they could test a couple of times during their quarantine, but the most important thing is really to stay away, right?
Right, is the quarantine, yes.
Okay. Okay, so the other question I have relates to the students then coming back in January.
Yes.
So is Cal Poly going to do anything different? Are they going to have fewer students on campus? Are they going to do more surveillance testing?
So, good question. So the nature of surveillance testing might change, but the quantity is probably going to be pretty similar. It might be increased. We'll have to see. So the research lab is trying to sort out how it could be more involved. And if that is possible, then it might increase the quantity of testing that happens. But my impression is that, you know, the next quarter will look very similar to this quarter.
They're planning the same density, so 5,000 students on campus and
right about the same. Yeah.
Okay.
Right, big sigh. So going is worrisome, staying is worrisome, coming back is worrisome.
And just to be clear, I love them, you know,
right.
I love them. I just, you know, right. want everybody to be safe.
Right. Yeah.
And then my third question related to COVID is just, do you have any update about our unhoused neighbors? Like any further news about what we're doing for them as we're moving into winter with COVID?
Good question. Right. I used to be very involved in that. Now I'm not as involved in that, but it's something that is being discussed at least two or three times a week. And the idea is to try to push the push the various shelter providers to come up with their own transportation plans, their own testing plans with our assistance. The idea being they received a fairly generous grant. So we're trying to sort of help them build their plans.
Okay. I wonder if there's someone that we could have come and give us an update on that, maybe as a future topic at some point. Would that be okay? Like,
I think that's a great idea.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That'd be great. I would love to hear what's going on.
I'd hate to volunteer Laurel for that, but she would be good.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. I'm sure she'll love that. She has no other Zoom meetings to go to or anything, right?
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions from commissioners? Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for coming tonight. I'm impressed that you're not totally worn down by now with all this. Quite a burden on your shoulders for too long a time. My question is, what is the relationship between the health department and Cal Poly administration in managing the apparent large numbers of students who are testing positive now? Are you charged with approving whatever plans Cal Poly administration comes up with? Do you have no power? What's that relationship?
Yes, so we do. So we communicate on a daily basis, and they run plans by us and do things, with our input and guidance. So it is. It's an ongoing daily communication.
Well, specifically, do you have any leverage with them?
Where are we? In terms of, I would say yes, but to an extent. So it depends on what you're getting at, sir.
I could only pose theoretic scenario. What if, and this is just off the wall, but what if the administration proposed a surveillance program that was grossly inadequate?
Okay. Right. So
the ball's in your court now, I assume.
Right. If that were the case, I think two things. One is we could recommend that they change it. And they, in our dealings, in our collaboration thus far, I think they would be amenable to doing that. Oh, there's a cat sneaking into the frame.
All evening.
Yeah. And the other potential outcome is that we could assist them with testing. So particularly in light of what the state is trying to do and pushing out more testing options to the various counties, that would also be an option. But I think that if anything, they're always looking to Cal Poly leadership and the Cal Poly health team are always looking to either improve or expand testing. They're constantly thinking about ways to do that. And they've been very good in terms of response testing and in terms of surveillance testing for higher risk activities like sports and music.
Well, thanks. I have a little better sense of the relationship now. Thank you, Rick.
Sure.
So this question, and Candace may know on this, Cal Poly, they haven't eliminated their sorority and fraternity activities, have they? Because they were testing, those 400 from two different sororities just in the last week or so? Nobody knows?
I don't know.
So there are five sororities that have been involved with clusters of cases. All of those sororities have been invited to test through the health center. And I would say that the take up from that is about 50 to 60%, which isn't bad. On the bright side, the fraternities have been doing okay.
It's a gender thing?
It's just the young women.
I think
women are so sociable anyway, right?
There are men at those parties too.
Yes, fair enough, yes.
Okay, any other questions?
Well, just along those lines, I know that my alma mater, UCSB, down the street, there was a big cluster of cases in Isla Vista as well. I assume there are some learnings just from neighboring counties and, really any college town on sort of best practice. I don't know if that's... I don't know if anybody really has had any best practice or has seen any success, but would be curious if you know if that exists or if that's something you guys are looking into.
So I don't think the challenges are unique to Cal Poly in terms of universities. It seems to, yeah.
Okay. Well, Dr. Rosen, thank you as always for being with us. If there's something that you need from us, don't hesitate to ask. We're here to support you and do what we can to get the word out. Are we pleased with the mask wearing at this point? It seems to me like I do actually see more people with the mask on than a month or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I would agree.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you again for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you all. Have a good night.
You too. So, commissioner updates. Who has something to report from some of their Zoom meetings, perhaps, or anything that's been going on? Bob, have you been going to a Tobacco Coalition? Seems like they've been Zooming regularly.
I think I reported on the last meeting at our last meeting. And the next monthly meeting is for tomorrow. So I'll have a report for you next month on Tobacco Coalition.
All right, good. Anybody else have anything?
Jean,
go ahead.
Just wanted to report on Adult Services Policy Council. They had two speakers. One was from Ready to Care from Santa to Senior. So that's a program that's out there. You know, you can adopt a senior. And the host of that, Tiffany Tara, out of Home Instead Senior Care. So if anyone was interested, you can visit that site. But the real interesting presentation was HICAP. They gave an outstanding presentation, and that's something that we should, and when we do start giving programs, you know, it's looking at the open enrollment season for Medicare, the differences between the traditional Medicare and the Advantage plans. A lot of people do not understand those, and they can really go down the wrong way if they're not careful. So it's one of those things that she gave an outstanding presentation. Anybody that has an organization like you, Tom, you could actually go and call HICAP, and then we'll give a presentation to your group. So that's what they gave, and that's something that was we should really promote as well.
And open enrollment ends next month.
Yes, but it's one of those things to be aware of.
Uh-huh.
Advantage plans versus traditional. Ask lots of questions. And the other thing that was I attended in the meantime was looking at the Coalition for Compassionate Care. I made a report to the Adult Services Policy Council about advanced healthcare directives and PULSE. And there's a national or and actually state looking at our PULSE as well as the advanced healthcare directive. And they're looking to put it in a registry form. So anyone that had any questions, you know, EMTs or whatever could actually go and look at a registry. It's not something that's in practice, but it's something we need to think about as a county at some point in time, because that is what they're looking at for the state of our, you know, California.
Somebody would have to develop the registry and maintain it. And
yes, and that's what the Coalition for Compassionate Care is doing at this point in time.
Okay.
So it's going forward. I just wanted you to be informed that it's not something that's on the back shelf. They really are promoting that, and you know, it's available as pilots in some of our counties. San Diego is the biggest county.
Okay. All right. Any other updates?
Mary Jean, I was say I might give you a call, but if there are some underrepresented organizations in need of a liaison, I'm open to your suggestions anyway down the road.
Well, we will be making some additions to that because we have Lynn with us and a couple of others. So Michael and I actually talked about that today for just a few minutes. So, yes, I will be in touch with you, Tom, shortly, and we'll get the information out to the different people that manage some of the committees so that you get on the mailing list for meetings in that. So, actually, that brings me to the next thing about typically December has always been a planning meeting for us. So, of course, we won't be meeting for dinner like we usually do in December, but I think we would like to still have our Zoom meeting be a planning meeting next month. So let's plan to bring our ideas for upcoming programs together. And then, at Michael's suggestion, the month of January, perhaps we can go dark that month and not meet. That will give him an opportunity to get caught up on all the minutes, which we do have to approve them as we go along the way. That'll give him a chance to redo our Zoom platform, which will allow us to have speakers who could bring PowerPoint presentations and some of those things, because it does appear that we will be meeting Zoom-wise for a while yet. And then, typically in the month of February, we've gone dark because there's always two Monday holidays. But we can talk about this at in the December meeting. If it's all right with all of you, since we're Zooming, we may want to meet in February, but maybe we could just, instead of a Monday, do it a different day of the week or that. We don't need to decide that right now. We can talk about that December. So think about what you'd like to hear about one of us, and maybe I'll have Mike do that. We'll pull up all those things we planned before the pandemic, because we had quite a few things that we wanted to hear about before then. But we need to, you know, rethink perhaps what's important at this point to hear about the urgent things that are in process. So, good. Any of our standing committees have anything to report? We are still looking for one more commissioner. If we can all keep that in mind, it would be a consumer position. And with that, if nobody has anything else that they'd like to add this evening, Mike, do you have anything to remind us about?
No reminders right now.
Okay.
I have one thing. Just for anybody, if anyone's listening to this meeting, the SLCUSD school district is running a flu vaccine kind of campaign these next 2 weeks. So if you're a parent of a child in that school district, including Morro Bay and Los Osos, they're having different schools with, 3 or 4 hour long windows of time. So you can look it up on your school websites for flu vaccines.
Okay, good to know. My grandsons went today for their flu vaccine. They did one of those drive-through clinics up in Sacramento. So I said, so what do? You stick your arm out the window? And they said, oh, no, you open your door. And they just, but it wasn't too bad. And they usually don't get a flu shot, so the good thing is that they're doing it this year. So, anybody else have anything? Well, with that, I think we will stand adjourned for the evening. Thank you all for being with us.
Good to see you.
Thank you, everybody.
Good to see you all.